This is James Corbett of CorbettReport.com. It's currently the 24th of July 2010 here in Japan and the 23rd of July in the United States, where I'm honored to be joined on the line by Ellen Brown, the author and best-selling researcher behind the highly popular book Web of Debt. And she has dedicated much of her time over the past several years researching the true nature of our debt-based money system and writing about genuine alternatives and solutions. She can be found at webofdebt.wordpress.com and ellenbrown.com. Ms. Brown, it's great to have you back on the program. Thank you for joining us today.
Thanks, James.
Well, Ms. Brown, this week on the Corbett Report, we're looking back to the past for a possible example of a type of currency system that we can implement going forward. So rather than, of course, the poisonous Federal Reserve note dollar system that's currently tottering on the brink of collapse. And I'm referring, of course, to the system of colonial scrip that was common throughout the American colonies prior to the War of Independence. And I know this is a topic that you've written and spoken about before, so perhaps you could start by giving us just a brief overview of what this colonial scrip was and how and where it was used.
Colonial scrip was first used actually a year before the Bank of England was founded. So it was 1693, first used by the governor of Massachusetts when he found himself in a local war and he didn't have the money to pay for it. They didn't have gold and silver in the colonies, and so he tried to borrow, but there was nobody to borrow. Nobody had the money to lend. So he got the idea that he would just write these little paper receipts that were, they're basically IOUs. And he paid the soldiers with it and paid the suppliers. And then those little receipts were traded in the community as money. And it was discovered that this worked very well, that you could just trade these little IOUs as money. So all the colonies started following that pattern in different forms. Some actually issued IOUs that were supposed to be redeemed later in hard currency, silver or gold, but some just circulated as legal tender. They were considered money in themselves. They never would be redeemed. Or some were technically supposed to be redeemed with taxes, but it was so far into the future that they never were actually redeemed. So this worked well, except the problem was that if they went out and they didn't come back to the government, in other words, they weren't redeemed, then eventually it would hyperinflate the system and drive prices up. So you'd have more and more money competing for the same number of goods, and that would drive prices up. But in Pennsylvania and in the middle colonies, they got another idea where instead of just having the money go out and not come back so that it winds up inflating the system, they would have the money lent to the farmers and to the citizens, and then it would come back to the lender. So the government was actually a lender. In Pennsylvania, the provincial government set up a land bank which the government owned, and it printed these same things, these IOUs, or bills of credit, as Benjamin Franklin called them, that were lent to the farmers. And it was called a land bank because supposedly this money was backed not by gold and silver, but by land. In other words, there were mortgages. The farmers would mortgage their land for these loans. And but in fact, they never collected the land. So it was just sort of it made it look good, you know, to have it backed by something, so they called it a land bank. So they, in Pennsylvania, they lent at 5% interest, whereas the British bankers were lending at 8% interest. And before that, nobody wanted to come to Pennsylvania because there was no money there. You couldn't get the loans from there. There weren't any British banks. So, and there was no gold and silver. So it was very difficult to get currency at all. So now the provincial government set up this land bank, lent to the farmers at 5% interest, and the money would come back to the government with interest, so it became a big moneymaker for the government during that bank was in place, which was from 1723 to the mid-1750s, when King George forbade the colonies to issue their own money, or it forbade new issues of colonial scrip. During that time, there was the government had no debts there were no taxes, and prices did not inflate. So it was a completely sustainable system. When you had the private bankers lending money, they created the principal for their loans, but they didn't create the interest. So they were always taking more money back than they put out there, which meant that somebody somewhere had to take out another loan to find the interest to pay principal on interest on the old loans. But in the colonial system, where it was the government-owned bank, the government could issue the interest or enough money to cover the interest on the side as to pay for government, you know, needs. So let's say you issued $105 in scrip. You could, colonial scrip is what they called this paper money. So you could issue like $100 at 5% interest. Then you could spend $5 on roads and bridges and things the government needed. And then the whole 105 would come back as principal and interest on the loan. So it was sustainable. You know, once you did that, you never had to print more money to keep the, to cover principal and interest and to keep the money circulating.
So it's fair to say that the Pennsylvania example was the most successful.
Right.
And explain again the difference between Pennsylvania and some of the other colonies.
Well, the northern colonies were the ones that tend to just print and print and print. It was all an experiment, and people didn't really know then about inflation and what the effects would be. So they tended to print lavishly for all the projects they thought they wanted, which actually worked in the sense that they got all these projects built that would not otherwise have been built. But it did tend to devalue the currency because there was just more and more of this paper money out there. So in Pennsylvania, that didn't happen because the money came back to the government. Benjamin Franklin was from Pennsylvania, and he was called the father of paper money. He wrote about it in this famous pamphlet that was circulated all over the colonies. And it was he who went to England when King George said we could no longer issue our own scrip. He went to England to argue about it, actually said the wrong thing because he made things worse. But anyway, he was the big proponent of this form of currency, although he didn't devise it. It was in Pennsylvania. It was, I think, set up by William Penn, the governor. But Franklin just saw what a good, he saw it operate and realized how much good it had done for the colony. And that's when he wrote about it.
Right. And I understand that Benjamin Franklin actually said that this was the issue that really led to the War of Independence.
Yes, there were a number of historians who said that, that what it was really about, in 1751, King George II forbade the colonies to issue new issues of paper money. In other words, they could still use what was out there, but they couldn't put out new money. And the reason was that the British merchants had complained because they were getting all this different kind of paper from different colonies, and nobody knew exactly what it was. Some of it was were IOUs, and some of it was supposed to be legal tender. It was backed or not backed. Some of it was good for certain types of debts. Some of it was good for all debts. So they complained that they weren't getting paid in something stable. Their money was losing value. So the king said they couldn't do it the colonists couldn't do it anymore. And then and so that immediately contracted the money supply. That was their money supply, and suddenly they can't issue anymore. So they started going into a depression. And Benjamin Franklin went to England and argued with Parliament, saying that this was responsible for the abundance in the colonies, and it was such a great system, and that they should allow it. Well, it sort of backfired because the Bank of England was they were issuing the money for England, and they were issuing their own paper bank notes and lending it to the government, and that was the national money supply. So they had a constant source of revenue from this paper money. This was the competitive form of paper money, which was banker issued rather than government issued. So they were always getting the interest on that money. They were it was supposedly backed by gold, but in fact, they would issue, they could issue up to 10 times as many paper notes as they had gold, because people only came for their notes, their gold 10% of the time. It was discovered by trial and error. So they tended to issue like about 6 times as many notes as they had gold. So that meant 5 of those notes were not backed by anything and getting interest on all of them. So it's a very good money-making deal for the bank. So they weren't real pleased when they realized that the colonists were essentially breaking away, that they had their own money system. They were getting the profits. They were getting, it's called the seigniorage, the profit from, or the benefit of being the issuer of the national money supply, instead of the bank itself getting the seigniorage. So they leaned on Parliament, the Bank of England leaned on Parliament to, or leaned on the king to forbid issues of paper money altogether in the colonies. So when that happened, then you had a serious depression going on, and the colonists were forced to pay taxes in basically a foreign currency. I mean, it's rather like third world countries having to pay the IMF. They had to pay in banknotes that they issued by the Bank of England that they had no power over. They didn't have gold and silver, so they had to borrow from the British. And that was the whole taxation without representation thing. That here they were being taxed in a currency over which they had no control, and they weren't represented, which meant it wasn't really their government. So they went back to printing their own money, as they had to do in order to have a money supply. And this was considered an act of rebellion because the king had, you know, very clearly said they couldn't do it.
So this wasn't all about the price of stamps or something like that.
No. Well, that the tea tax was that. So the tea they were objecting to, the East India Company did not have to pay the same tax that the colonists themselves had to pay. So that's why they were dumping this tea in the ocean, that it was competing with their own tea, that was more expensive for them. So they dressed up as Indians and did this. It was just an act of rebellion that they were not going to allow this tea into their harbors. But the basic tax issue was actually a money issue. What they were basically objecting to was that they had to pay taxes, not in their own currency, and they weren't allowed to issue their own currency.
Right. So you point out that the Pennsylvania example was technically backed up by land, but you point out that was mostly cosmetic and that it really didn't matter that specifically what it was backed up by.
Right. It's not like they were actually, Benjamin Franklin called it coined land, but in fact, nobody ever traded in their chips for land. That was just supposedly the security behind this currency.
Right. So you realize that's going to drive the gold bugs crazy.
Because it is backed by nothing.
Hmm. Yeah. And yet it was not hyperinflationary.
No. And actually what causes this whole cycle of inflation, gold itself is actually, or gold-backed money is actually inflationary, because always historically, many times more paper money is issued than there actually is gold. And so what you would have is that the bankers would be inflating the money supply, so you'd have a bubble. But because it was tethered by gold, they could only do this up to a certain extent, at a certain point. And then when people realized that the banks didn't actually have the money, or didn't actually have the gold to cover all those banknotes that were out there inflating the money supply, then they would all rush to the bank at once, and that would be a bank run, and then the bank would close the doors, and then there would be a depression. So you would have these cycles of inflation and depression, inflation, depression. Now, it may not have gone into hyperinflation, but it certainly went into inflation. It was actually an unstable system. It was more stable in the Pennsylvania colony. That was a totally stable system. It did not inflate. They did not have to add more money to the system, because you put the money out there and it came back to the government with interest, then you could put the enough money out to cover principal and interest again, and it would just all circulate it.
Yeah, very interesting concept. Has the concept of scrip been used elsewhere or at a different time in history?
Well, I don't know that they would. Paper money, government-issued paper money was essentially initiated by the American colonists. But before that, in the British colonies, they used sticks of wood that were called tallies. And this worked for like 500 years, where these were essentially receipts for the payment of taxes. So they were not sticks that the tax collector would give to the taxpayer, or anything that was paid to the government. You would get these notched sticks that would show that how much you had contributed. So the stick was then split in half, and it would have the notches would indicate its value. And because no stick split, no two sticks split in the same way, it was foolproof against forgery that the other half of the stick was kept by the tax collector and given to. Actually, they were checking on the tax collectors to make sure that they had collected the right amount of money, but it was given to the government then, and it was kept as a record of this tax that had been paid. So the other half of the stick circulated in the community, and the reason it maintained its value was that these were good for the payment of taxes. The government would accept these in the payment of taxes, and the notches had a certain value, and they retained their value. That, you know, whatever, five notches or whatever, was always five notches. Tax was. So during the period that they had these tally sticks in force, some people say that this was just a minor part of the economy, but it actually wasn't. The tally stick trade was bigger, or substantially bigger, than the amount of trade that was conducted in silver and gold. And so it was basically just an economy of receipts, of keeping track of who owed what, who had paid and who owed. Rather than thinking of money as something you dig out of the ground and you have to have the money first, and you, if you don't have it, you have to go borrow it from somebody else who dug it out of the ground. Money in a tally system, or in what we have today, which is basically a fiat system, is only a series of legal agreements. Money only represents an accounting tool that shows what has been paid and what has been owed, and, you know, accrual over time, that sort of thing. In fact, there's some quite interesting accounting theories that I've seen lately. Like apparently in New Zealand, they've funded projects by something they call accrual accounting, although it's not really what we call accrual accounting. But anyway, you assume that the project is already built before you build it, so you're actually monetizing the project. So you write the project itself up on one side of the books as if it has already accrued, and then you issue the money on the other side of the books against that project. So the project is the collateral for the loan, and then the money goes out, pays workers and materials. The thing is built, and then you sell the thing to pay back the loan, or just the existence of the thing pays back the loan. In other words, the government used to have a debt, and now it has an asset equal to the debt, so that extinguishes the debt.
So in a way, then, if we take the power of fiat money back into the hands of the people, it can be used for good.
Right. You can. Well, I saw this in the Commonwealth Bank of Australia was a very good model of a bank. It's a publicly owned bank that funded many projects for most of the last century, and when it was first set up, that was what they were talking about. It was funded, it was backed by the credit of the people, or the productivity of the people, and that you could build anything you could envision, that you could create the credit for the thing that you wanted to build. You would use the credit to pay workers' materials, build it, and the credit of the community itself was the money.
Right, exactly. So basically, I know that you write often about the state-owned bank solution as a solution for our current banking system. Do you see a colonial scrip type system playing a role in that state-owned bank system that you'd like to see implemented?
Well, states are not allowed under the Constitution to issue bills of credit, which means paper money. I mean, that's the way it's been interpreted. So you have to sort of work around that. But all of our money today is created by banks, or what circulates in the system as money is the credit of banks. So if a state owns its own bank, it doesn't have to issue like the dollars of Massachusetts or the dollars of Michigan. It can issue Federal Reserve notes in the sense that all banks create dollars on their books. I mean, they create a loan, and the loan, they create it as a liability to themselves and an asset to themselves. That's the way they do it, double entry bookkeeping. And then the money, the loan goes into the deposit account of the borrower, and then the borrower writes checks on it. Well, those checks go out in Federal Reserve notes. Those are actual dollars. So it's not like the bank issued the dollars, and yet the dollars somehow came out of the bank and went out into the economy and circulated as money. So a publicly owned bank can do the same thing and can actually literally increase the money supply in the same way that all banks do. That you have to cover it with deposits when the checks go out in order for the checks to clear, but the deposits are coming in. You're not really spending those deposits. You actually created new money that went out in the form of checks, and then you've got your deposits here that theoretically clear those checks, but really the deposits are totally independent. I mean, Mr. Jones's check that just came in has nothing to do with Mr. Smith's check that just went out. Mr. Smith didn't really borrow from Mr. Jones, but it's just an accounting tool, or I think it's a ruse really, where they clear checks by saying that the bank has to have the same amount coming in as going out. And if they don't have the same amount coming in, they borrow it. So effectively, right now, the Fed funds rate is 0.2%. So effectively, what happens is, let's say you make a $1,000 loan. The loan becomes a deposit, which becomes a check, which goes out of the bank. In order to clear that check, it has gone into another bank, which now has $1,000 in excess reserves. And you, the first bank, is short reserves. So the first bank effectively borrows back that $1,000 it just created at 0.2%. So it's added $1,000 to the system, and it got the money for 0.2%, and it lent it at whatever, 5% or 6% or something, and it keeps the spread. So that's where our money comes from. But there actually are many community currencies right now. Those are allowed. Strangely, I know there was those silverback dollars, what were they called?
The Liberty dollars, yeah.
Yeah, the Liberty dollars. They got into legal trouble, I think, because they looked too much like dollars. And so it was considered an attempt at counterfeiting, which, of course, we know it wasn't. But that, I think that was the charge. But if you make some sort of, or say you have a currency that's basically just numbers on a computer. I belong to a small community currency, and all it is credits and debits. They're called favors. So you've got, you grant somebody favors, or you borrow favors. Like, say if somebody washes your car and you say, I'll pay you 5 favors to wash my car, and then you write that you have a debit of 5 and they have a credit of 5. So you haven't counterfeited any money here. All you've done is create credits and debits on a computer program. So that's legal. There's no problem there. And then there are things like Berkshire shares and all sorts of community currencies that actually do augment the money supply. So it's a good thing when, like right now, we have a depression, they're calling it a recession. But if you look around here in Michigan, where I'm right now, it is a depression. It looks a lot like a depression.
Absolutely. So, And of course, it's been noted that the Depression was really a contraction of the money supply. It was fundamentally what the Great Depression was about.
Yeah. So when in Argentina, when literally in 2001 and also in 1995, when literally the money supply collapsed, like there was no money, they had a big community currency, which was basically just these little paper receipts that they traded with each other, and that was very popular. And it was, at the time, it was the biggest community currency in the world. So that was one thing they did to augment the money supply. Plus, the local governments, municipal governments, they owed their their workers, and they didn't have any money to pay them with. So they paid them with IOUs, which were basically just, you know, again, just little paper money receipts, and those traded in the community just as if they were money. And then when in 2001, when the Argentina told the IMF that they just didn't have the money, go away, come back later, they actually issued pesos. The federal government issued pesos and paid for the things, built the things they needed. And that was not inflationary until they got up to full employment. So for the next 3 years, it worked very well to just issue pesos and pay for what the government needed. And then 3 years later, they did hit full employment, and then it started to get inflationary. So that's when they did, you know, wage and price controls and different things. But for the period, when you don't have enough money in the system, then all these ways of getting money into the system do not create inflation. They just create productivity.
Exactly. Well, Ellen Brown, I know this entire conversation is going to infuriate the gold bugs and the Austrians in the audience, but I think it's really is time to start thinking about ways that we can take the power of the creation of currency back into our own hands and use them constructively rather than basing an entire economy on digging things out of the ground, as you say. So on that note, tell people about your website and where they can go for more of your articles on economic matters.
My website is webofdebt.com. And my book is Web of Debt, my book on this subject. This is actually my 11th book, and it's available on my website or on Amazon or theoretically in bookstores, so you might have to ask for it. And I have many articles on webofdebt.com/articles.
Yes, you do, and they are highly recommended as they are valuable contributions to people looking for solutions to our economic problems. So, Ellen Brown, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us today, and I hope we can have you back on in the future.
Thank you, James.